You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is the 1st of April 2019. It's April Fool's Day, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. And I'm very pleased to say that we have with us once again today Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing great. It's a lovely sunny day. I've been observing what's been going on in the news and what of the demonstrations that have been going on down in London. And there's quite a lot of interesting stuff going on at the moment.
Yeah, we're actually pre-recording this before April Fool's Day. We're actually recording this on Sunday. And I do believe that they're going to be trying to push Theresa May's glittery turd through the Parliament once again, actually on April Fool's Day itself, which does seem... does seem rather apt to be having that going on. It is just so foolish. It's ridiculous what's been going on. I mean, we talked about this last week, didn't we? And we said, you know, this deal, they've been told that they can't put it through another time because they've already tried to put it through twice. And then the EU said, well, we want you to put it through. And they just jumped and put it through Parliament again. Apparently what they did, they removed a part from it called the political preamble, but didn't make any other changes to the rest of it. Of course, that failed once again. And now they're going to push it through again on Monday to see whether they can get it through one last time. It just makes Britain the laughing stock of the world. But what I've been thinking, the way I've been looking at this, because the EU have said if it doesn't pass, we have to leave on April the 12th. If we don't want to leave on April the 12th and we want to lengthen the time, then we will have to join in with the EU elections. And of course, if we join in with the EU elections, it's a wonderful chance for a protest vote. And I can see Tommy Robinson winning hands down and being in the European Union Parliament, because I can imagine a lot of lefties and Labour would vote for him just out of sheer anger at the betrayal of the British government of the British people. So I could see that Tommy Robinson would get into the EU Parliament. Nigel Farage would be back in there. Count Dankula, he would probably get in as well. You'd have a lot of people that really hate the EU. So the EU don't want that. Plus, it would make the British government just look so ridiculous, because they've been telling everyone how Tommy Robinson is hated and he's a racist and nobody likes him and all the rest of it. And I'm sure he would get voted in. So they've got a choice. They can either leave with no deal and World Trade Organization terms, or they can have Tommy Robinson in the Parliament. And it's going to be, which one of those do they like the least or dislike the worst? If you see what I mean. I see they've got that choice of two. So that may be why they're breaking procedure again and trying to force this through on Monday, because these thoughts must have gone through their minds. And maybe, again, Theresa May is going to use that to try and force this vote through on the Monday. So if it does fail, I can see those are the next two options. And both of those options, to me, sound great, you know?
Yeah, I was... kind of imagining the other day actually that the hand of divine providence was somehow steering circumstances and frustrating the machinations of our political elite so that they would end up with an outcome from all of this which is exactly what they don't want. And it seems as if, as you say, we are being steered towards a choice between a no deal Brexit or a European Parliament with some very active anti-European Union activists amongst their ranks. And it's a very, very interesting situation, kind of amusing in certain ways. And it will be very interesting to see how things pan out.
Well, we've also had, as you mentioned, we've had the Brexit betrayal marches went off on Friday. I was very impressed with that. I mean, tens of thousands of people. I mean, it may have been hundreds of thousands of people. It certainly looked absolutely full up. And as far as I can make out, there were only four or five arrests. If that four or five arrests out of all those people, which I think shows you that it's not the nationalists that are the troublemakers. The trouble only happens when the left wing are allowed to attack the nationalists. And the nationalists, of course, defend themselves. And then the nationalists get arrested for that and they throw the book at them. And the Antifa, if they do get arrested, they've got very rich lawyers provided for them by the likes of George Soros through his middlemen, Hope Not Hate. And they get let off. So it seemed to me that because this march was outside Westminster, they must have kept them apart. I mean, four or five arrests, that's hardly anything at all for thousands of people. I think Tommy Robinson also played his Panorama documentary outside on a big screen as well. I think I saw Gerard Batten's speech, but it looked like people were there all there through the evening. And then there was somebody that actually managed to hold up all the trains. Just one man. He climbed onto the roof of a train station, draped in a St George's flag, and just held all the trains up. Just one man.
I mean, yeah, it was evident from the news media when they were giving their accounts of these demonstrations that they were almost praying that there would be some violence that they could televise. And I can't remember the exact wordings that were used or whatever, but particularly when we were getting towards the evening and it was starting to get dark. There were continual statements by people in the news media that everything seems to be quite calm and law abiding at the moment. You know, as if any minute now there could be violence breaking up because of all these right wing white people that were assembled there. And there was even Jon Snow apparently on television blurted out that he'd never seen so many white people all in one place at the same time, or words to that effect, which kind of says a fair bit about him, but is also quite a bizarre thing to say on television.
He's had to apologise for that. He's had to apologise for that. They've pulled him up on that and said that's a very racist statement to make. But of course, that's why there was no trouble, because it's majority white people. White people get on. We don't want to cause trouble. We don't want to fight among ourselves. You've got a lot of people there that are united, that love their country, that really love their country. I mean, this is off topic slightly here, but Jared Taylor, I mean, he was banned from entering Europe. He got all the way to Sweden for a conference on Friday, only to be told that he was actually banned from the Schengen area and he had to be sent back. And I mean, that man he's so peaceful. And he loves Europe so much. He's a total Europhile. And they're sending back somebody that loves Europe. And at the same time, they're letting in all these jihadis. I mean, we've got thousands of jihadis just in Britain. But the people that love Europe, they're sending back to America. And what you had on that Friday, you had lots of people that love Britain, that love their country, patriots, that feel really, really badly let down by the treasonous elites. I mean, it is treason. They've gone directly against the wishes of the people. They asked for the wishes of the people. The people said, we want to leave the EU. What part of that do they not understand? How does that get turned into soft Brexit, hard Brexit, do a deal, stay in the customs union, backstop, all this rubbish that they've tried to split Brexit up into? I mean, it was just one question with one answer: leave the EU. And they talk about Theresa May's red lines as if she just plucked them out of thin air. But they were actually, it was actually when you break down, what is Brexit? Well, it means you leave the customs union. It means you leave the political union, and it means that you leave the legal side of it as well. And that's what Brexit is. It's all three of those. And her deal didn't manage to satisfy those. It didn't manage to satisfy either side. The only way you can actually have a proper Brexit is to leave with World Trade Organization terms, which they could have done the very next day after this vote. And I do think we still stand a good chance of that being what's going to happen. I mean,
yeah, it was interesting that on Friday, the ex chairman of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, was being interviewed on the BBC, and he stated there that he felt that us leaving on World Trade Organization terms was the best outcome now. What he said was that all the scare stories and the scaremongering that's been going on was just that, scare stories and scaremongering. He didn't see why there was any reason to believe that Britain would fare any worse outside of the European Union than it would within the European Union. And he also pointed out that in his view, the government, when they had the opportunity to make all the preparations that would be necessary for us to move smoothly onto World Trade Organization terms, the government made a conscious decision not to do that. And that now we're in a situation where it could be that, as I said earlier on, by the divine hand of providence, we might be steered onto World Trade Organization terms, but we will be on WTO terms without the lots of the preparation that should have been made having already been done. And so Mervyn King was saying that in his view, the government should ask the European Union for a 6 month delay during which the preparations for no deal can take place, and then we should just leave on a no deal basis, and in that intervening 6 month period, you know, not make any further efforts to try and negotiate a deal. And I think that was very refreshing from Mervyn King, and it's an indication that even amongst people who we would have assumed are part of the political elite, there are now people that are honest, that are coming forward and trying to advise the country and trying to advise us as to the best way forward, without having any axe to grind with regard to their own political careers, etc. Because Mervyn King is now Lord King, he's in the House of Lords, it won't benefit him or adversely affect him one way or the other. Now he's in a position where he can actually speak his mind, and it's interesting to hear what his mind is when he actually speaks it.
Well, that is what they should have been doing for the last 2 years, isn't it? Is preparing for this and saying, well, if you don't like our deal, we are all ready to go. We're ready to go on World Trade Organization terms. But of course they haven't. I mean, they just thought that Theresa May would be able to force this deal through that the EU wanted. I mean, it's just what they want more than anything else. Of course, she's also, well, she hasn't actually said exactly when she's going to leave, but she said once again that yes, she is going to leave once this little part of the deliberations is over, which again, just leave on World Trade Organization terms and then step down. That's what she should be doing. That's what I've been saying. I think is going to happen since Christmas. I've been saying I think we're going to be leaving on World Trade Organization terms, and then she's going to step down. Are you trying to say something there, Max?
Yeah, I was just going to say that again, another comment by Mervyn King was that the thing that prevented Theresa May from being able to negotiate a more acceptable deal was the very fact that right from early on, Parliament and those the Remainers within the government and the cabinet had pushed for the government to quite clearly state that they would not leave on World Trade Organization terms. And of course, in a negotiating situation, that was the only bargaining counter we had. The only bargaining counter we had was that if the European Union didn't offer us suitable terms, that we would walk away and it would be WTO terms. The moment we said that we were never going to walk away on World Trade Organization terms, that then left us with no bargaining counter whatsoever. And the whole process that Theresa May's gone through now has just been a process of her going to the European Union and saying, please, will you give us something to make my deal appear more attractive? And they said no. And so she's come away again. And then she's gone back again and effectively just said to them again, please, 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 will you give me something to make my deal appear a little bit more attractive? And they said no. And so after, you know, 2.5 years or more, here we are at the point where we should have been leaving the European Union, and she's no further forward. She hasn't really got much further forward than David Cameron did. You know, David Cameron was in a situation where he feebly tried to negotiate better terms with the European Union. And of course, the European Union knew that as far as he was concerned, that he was never going to walk away. And that was proven by virtue of the fact that he resigned immediately after the Brexit result. And so we've had these two Tory leaders, both of which have denied themselves the only bargaining counter they could possibly have, and both of them failing miserably to actually achieve anything in the negotiations.
The EU have known all along that their biggest supporters are the Remainers that are in the Houses of Parliament. I mean, 3/4 of the Houses of Parliament are all Remainers. I mean, there is a process underway at the moment to kick out the members of the Tory party that have voted against what their constituencies said. And it was a massive majority of constituencies that apart outside of London that all voted to leave the EU. And yet their representatives in the Houses of Parliament are going totally against that. There's also another interesting development with the independent group that was made up of Chucka Amuna, Luciana Berger, and a couple of other feminist conservatives, all the real feminist progressive types from the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, that they both left their parties and formed this other group called the Independent Group. And they've now registered as a political party, and you just won't believe the name that they've actually chosen for this party. It's Change UK, and obviously the letters of that is cuck. It's the cuck party, made up of the biggest cucks in politics. That just shows you how divorced they are from the general public that they would pick a name like that. They must have just never heard the term, or it must have just not occurred to them. But that is what they're calling themselves. And I mean, to call themselves Change, and that's exactly what they don't want. They don't want any change at all. They just want it exactly the same, still in the EU. And they're now calling themselves the Cuck Party. So good luck to them. Obviously, we're going to have a lot of fun with that name. We've also had a rather interesting trial that's been going on over the last couple of weeks. We've covered the previous trials of people that are alleged members of National Action. And there's been a new trial on, which we haven't spoken about yet here at Radio Aryan. It concerns 4 people. They're all under the age of 25. Well, they're all under the age of 23, actually. A young lady called Alice Cutter, her boyfriend Mark Jones, somebody else Gary Jack, and Connor Scotthern. And they're all being accused of being members of National Action after the organisation was banned. And it seems that the reason for this suspicion is that they were in a chat room or in a chat group with somebody else who has already been found guilty of continuing to be a member. So it's not that this chat room was set up by National Action, or it was even set up by ex-members of National Action. It was just that somebody that has been found guilty of being in National Action after the ban was using this chat room. And so far, this trial hasn't concerned any of that. There was a lot of hyperbole involved in the opening statements and a lot of inaccuracies. And of course, they can say anything they like about National Action now, because the actual National Action website that they had, which had all their writings on it, which explained their views and all the rest of it, that was taken down. So really, the prosecutor can say anything he likes about what National Action's ideology was, and there's nothing available anywhere that can contradict him. So that is how it started, with this massive load of hyperbole. And then since then, I mean, you can just run off the headlines that we've seen. I've picked 5 of them here. There was one that said, National Action trial, accused had wedding edition of Mein Kampf. And what does that have to do with anything? I mean, Mein Kampf is, I think it's the second best-selling book in the world. The best-selling book is the Bible. I think the second is Mein Kampf. What has that got to do with people being accused of being members of National Action? And what does it matter that it's a wedding edition? And that was a whole article on the BBC that merited an entire article, the fact that the accused had a copy of Mein Kampf. Another one was National Action trial, accused had Nazi women's badge. Apparently, the alleged member, Alice Cutter, she had one of those, the women's organisations. I think it's a little badge with a blue cross on it, something like that. So she had a badge. So what? What has that got to do with saying that they're members of National Action? Then they had National Action neo-Nazi entered Miss Hitler beauty contest, which is not contested. And that happened back when the organization were legal. So this is all information that really doesn't have any bearing on the case. Another one, National Action trial, Nazi accused, obsessed with ethnic cleansing. And then it just says that in chat rooms, she would talk about wanting to cleanse the country of ethnics. And then another one, National Action trial, Nazi accused, told to burn evidence. And this, I mean, this is just unbelievable what was actually said here. I've got an actual quote about this because I can't believe that this is actually being used against them. Birmingham Crown Court was told the pair received an email telling them to throw away or burn any memorabilia following police counter-terror raids. And this was just after National Action were banned. Prosecutors said the message sent by another NA member showed that they were part of the group. Barnaby Jameson QC prosecuting said it was a masterpiece of back covering. The message, headed Recent News, read, "I am sure you have all heard the news that four men have been arrested on the grounds that they are members of the terrorist organisation NA. Advising several recipients to distance themselves from NA, the message added, delete any affiliations you have to the group. Throw away or burn any memorabilia you are holding onto. If anyone is caught breaking the NA prescription or advocating for NA or even holding any NA memorabilia, they will be kicked from the group. Stay safe and be smart. They are watching the far right's every step now, and if even one of us slips up, it will cost all of us. This is an all-for-one and one-for-all situation." I mean, to me, that says that, no, they're nothing to do with NA. And they're terrified that because of the fact that they might have had NA propaganda or memorabilia back from when the group was legal, they are terrified that they'd be arrested for it. And that says to me that they're not members of it, and yet that is being used as specific evidence to suggest that they are members of this group. When, I mean, we gave out information like that on here at Radio Area, and when the group was banned, we said, look, anybody that was a member, please get rid of anything you have that linked you to them, because you are taking the risk of getting sent to prison for 10 years if they think that you're still active with them. You know, I think everybody took this very, very seriously, this ban. And I think these people here took it seriously. And because they said, just destroy any connection you had to do with them, they're saying, well, that means that they were still a part of them post-ban. I don't understand why this is being used against them. Max, have you been following this trial?
I've not been following it intensely, although I have been reading some of the articles. This all comes down to the Terrorism Act, and the fact that the Terrorism Act doesn't actually advise, and there are no guidelines issued by the government or anything of that sort, as to what somebody should do if they are a member of a group which is then proscribed. Because you can imagine a situation where you have two brothers, for example, that have been raised similarly, that have very similar views, and they may both join the same organisation, and then that organisation may subsequently be proscribed, and they may dissociate themselves from that organisation, but they're brothers still. So they will still meet on family occasions. They will perhaps still go out for a drink together occasionally. They will perhaps discuss politics at some point in the future. They may message each other on Facebook about things that interest them in the news that are perhaps political. And as I say, the Terrorism Act doesn't indicate what somebody should do if they are a member of a prescribed group. And as I say, there are no government guidelines. And so, you know, are you supposed to never speak to your brother ever again? Or are you never supposed to speak to somebody who perhaps isn't your brother, but perhaps has been a lifelong friend? You may have somebody who, you know, that you went to school with, that you've been a friend with for virtually all your life since you were a toddler or something. You know, are you supposed to never, ever go and see that person again? Are you supposed to never communicate with that person again for fear that it will be regarded as you associating with somebody who also was a member of the organization and therefore showing, you know, providing evidence that you were a member of that organization? And so what the government needs to do, if they're going to go around making organizations or prescribing organizations in this way, they do need to issue some guidelines that people can adhere to, and so they then know what's going on. And, you know, if even just, you know, keeping something that's memorabilia, you know, that could actually be a photograph of yourself at a demonstration. And I'm not just talking about National Action here. I'm talking about any organization that could theoretically be prescribed at some point in the future. You could be a member of an organization and you could have a photograph of yourself attending a meeting of that organization prior to it having been prescribed. You know, perhaps even 5 years prior to it having been prescribed, you could, the organisation can then be prescribed, and you could dissolve your membership of the organisation, never attend any of that organisation's meetings ever again. But you might still keep this photograph because it might be a photograph that's got sentimental value to you. Oh yeah, this is something that linked me to. This is something that I'm keeping out of sentimentality because of a long-standing friendship I had with somebody who was also a member of that organization. Well, you know, that's not you keeping stuff, keeping material that can be used to promote the organization. That's just you keeping something which is memorabilia, which is just like, you know, a photograph of when you were at school. Do the government expect you then to burn every photograph that you've got where you were in any way linked to the organization that has now been prescribed but wasn't prescribed when the photograph was taken? Do they expect you to burn every single piece of literature if you are somebody who might be accused of being a member of a prescribed organization? Are you banned from retaining propaganda material that organization had just for reference purposes, just in case you do get prosecuted, so that you've got that reference material so that you can use it to build your defense in court? Because what they're expecting people to do apparently is to just burn everything, to divest themselves of any evidence they could possibly use to defend themselves, and also then to dissolve any long-standing relationships that they've had with everybody else that's been a member of that organization in order to avoid getting prosecuted. And it just seems because of these prosecutions, that there is a need for some kind of guidelines to be produced so that people know where they stand.
It does seem like a very big failing to me. I mean, that's a big failing, isn't it? Because that's right. You've got all these cases.
When an organisation, when somebody within an organisation realises that all of the stuff which is just innocent memorabilia is being used as evidence that somebody is still a member of the organisation, when that person then emails or messages somebody saying, whatever you do, get rid of all this stuff because it's going to be used as evidence against you. You can't just rely on it being regarded as harmless memorabilia. The very fact they send that message is used as evidence of the fact they're trying to cover up. In reality, it's just they're trying to avoid each other being prosecuted for something that that was a thing of the past.
Well, it seems that they're being, you know, it's being used against them here that they did try to destroy the memorabilia. But in other cases, it's been used the fact that they had memorabilia that was used to convict people in the last one. They said that they found National Action propaganda either on the computer or in the form of stickers or what have you. And that was used as evidence to gain a conviction. And what they're saying here is because they were trying to get rid of that that's evidence that we're going to use to try and attain a conviction. So that because they don't have a guide for what people should do if an organization gets prescribed, they can, you know, they can pick and choose, can't they? The prosecutors can pick and choose and do whatever they like because there isn't anything out there to advise these young people. I mean, it's terrible. I don't think any of these, you know, any of the people that have been accused of this had any idea that this was likely to happen to them. I think, I think a lot of them thought, well, National Action has been folded. The organizers have said it's all been folded. And I should imagine that's why people didn't send in, you know, resignation notices, because maybe that would have been a way that they could have protected themselves, send in a resignation notice. But what happened was the organizers effectively did that and said, well, the organization is now shut down. It is no more. And then you've got people that thought, well, surely I can still be an activist for another organization or form another organization. But it seems that people that were ex-members, if they went on to do that, then it would be classed as a franchise of National Action, which people know now. But people didn't know that at the time. I don't think anybody had any idea what the outcome of the prescription was going to be. Just what it is that they would be expected to do or what not to do. Because nobody thinks, well, yeah, isn't it great? I'm going to do my best to try and get myself sent to prison. You know, that's not the way people think. And from the talks that I've had with the ex-people that were actually running it, you know, these people, they were doing their best not to fall foul of these laws. But because there was no guidelines, like, you know, the Crown Prosecution Service can make it up as they go along. And I think this case here is their attempt to push the boundaries and see how far they can push the boundaries and still get the juries to go along with it. Because all of these headlines have nothing to do with whether they're members of National Action or not. In actual fact, one of the accused stood up and said, is it my views that are on trial here? Or am I being charged with being a member of a prescribed organisation? Because this is what they're doing, looking at their views.
Yep. The people concerned are damned if they do and are damned if they don't with regard to how they handle the memorabilia and pre-existing friendships and relationships that they've had with other people who were also who are also ex-members of an organisation that's been prescribed. And as far as all these things are concerned, and whether somebody owns a copy of Mein Kampf or not isn't proof of whether they were a member of National Action after National Action was prescribed. Whether somebody owns a piece of World War II Nazi memorabilia in the form of a women's badge, that doesn't prove that they are or are not or were not a member of National Action after National Action was banned. The fact that somebody entered a Miss Hitler competition and all these other things, these are not proof of somebody being a member of a prescribed organization. What the prosecution should be required to provide is a membership list, which lists that person as a member of the organization post the point at which National Action was dissolved, or a membership card made out in that person's name that was renewed after the point when National Action was prescribed, or some statement made by the person where they speak out in promotion of the organisation that's been banned subsequent to the banning date. And if somebody's not spoken out, if they've not been to a meeting of that organisation after the date that it was banned, and if they haven't, if they don't feature on a membership list or have a membership card, then there is no evidence to prove that they were a member of that organisation. And all that's happening is they hear that people are being smeared, and they're ending up being found guilty on the basis of smears that have got nothing to do with their National Action membership, and which are just based around the person's underlying belief system And it's not their underlying belief system that is on trial. It is the it's whether or not they were a member of a prescribed organisation or not.
Well, you also brought up there, but you know, if you had these two brothers and that may have been involved, what you've got here is you've got this girl, Alice Cutter, and you've got her boyfriend. Now, her boyfriend, I think he said that he was a member of National Action and he left the organisation, but she was never a member. And they're saying that she was a member because she took part in this Miss Hitler competition. Now, I don't think National Action ever had any women involved in it. For the same reason that I don't think they had any disabled people involved in it, because if you're doing demonstrations, then women and disabled people are a risk because you would need to be protecting them. And I know that what they wanted was really fit young people under the age of 30 that were mentally, had a high IQ and also were very, very physically fit, because they knew that they would be attacked by the Antifa. And I don't think they ever allowed women in there in the first place. And if their information was still available online, I think you would find that somewhere. But of course it's not available online, and they're saying that she was a member because she did this Miss Hitler beauty thing, but I don't think she was at all. So it's all been very, very biased against these young people concerned. It's like using a sledgehammer to crack a walnut, using a nuclear weapon to crack a walnut with the legislation that they actually used to do this. And I'm sure the people involved I don't think they would ever have anything to do with activism ever again, because of this. And a lot of the young people in Britain now, they're terrified of getting involved in nationalism because of this example that's been made out of these young people. And I find it very sad when we get elder nationalists and they condemn these young people that have been arrested for this, because we don't know the truth behind it. We know that they've been accused of being members of National Action, they've been accused of still being members after the prescription. But we don't know why that is. We don't know if it's just tenuous links like it looks like it is here, or whether it's genuine. But to just cut those people off and say, oh, well, they've just, dragged nationalism's name in the mud. They're still young people that, whether they've gone about it the right way or the wrong way, they were still trying to serve their nation. They were still trying to do the right thing. And when they're in prison, they're cut off from everybody else. And I would have thought that nationalist hearts would go out to them and want to write to them and not just think, well, we should just cut these people off because they've dragged nationalism's name through the mud. They may have made mistakes, they may have made silly mistakes, but they still thought that they were putting their nation first. That's the way I look at it. I do find it a bit sad when I hear elder nationalists, elder statesmen, saying we should have nothing to do with these people. We shouldn't write to them. We should cut them off. Because to me, it's young people that may have made a mistake, which is going to last with them for the rest of their lives. A lot of the time, their family cut them off. Their friends cut them off. They've been accused of being terrorists, and they're all on their own in a prison where they get attacked by the Muslims. Terrible, terrible state for them to be in. And Christian Charity says that we should have Christian Charity, a nationalist charity.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Thanks for backing me up on that, Max. Well, we've also got another court case, another unfortunate court case that has recently just taken place. And this was a Britain First one. Paul Golding and Jada Franson were both in court, and I think there were a couple of other members of Britain First as well, and this took place in Northern Ireland. Paul Golding was found not guilty. And the other two members of Britain First, they were found not guilty. But unfortunately, Jada Franson was found guilty of hate speech. She's going to be sentenced next month. This is what they had to say. The court heard that Franson told those gathered at the rally that there was no moderate version of Islam and that these people are baying for our blood. Now, I'm reading this out here so that people can look at what she said so they can make certain they don't say something similar, because this is obviously something that could get you into trouble. She added, "Islam says every single one of you wonderful people here today deserves to be killed." Now, maybe she could have said the Quran says that infidels should be killed, and where she says that there's no moderate version of Islam, obviously the government puts forward these moderate Muslims. So there is a version of Islam that's moderate. It's just that it's not Quranic. It actually goes against bits of the Quran. Those attending the rally were then told it was time for the world to come together against the one common enemy. The judge told the court, "I'm satisfied these words were intended to stir up hatred and arouse fear." He also found her guilty over a separate filmed incident at a Belfast peace wall in December 2017. On that occasion, the court heard that Franson declared the Islamification of Britain will lead to similar walls to separate the two sides. She claimed the country was descending into civil war and said it was time to rise up against the biggest threat against the entire world. And that reminds me of Jez Turner's trial, where part of that was he said something about soldiers, rise up. So obviously that's something that people should avoid saying, is encouraging people to rise up against the threat. Confirming a conviction for that episode, the judge said, "I am satisfied that the words were menacing in nature." So I think we need to be very accurate about what we're talking about. We need to be very, very specific and not use language that, the whole of Islam says that all these people should be killed, because that's not true for a start. But also you can fall foul of these laws, and they do really seem to be going for Jada Franson. She's also had trouble with the probation service. When she came out of prison, she was expecting to go back to her home. She's got a mortgage on a house in Northern Ireland that was actually doxed as well by the press. And she was expecting to go back there, and the probation people said, "No, you can't. You've got to stay in London. You've got to stay in this bail hostel so that you can attend your probation meetings." And she couldn't afford to stay in a hotel. She could only stay at the probation hostel, I guess, for a month or whatever. She couldn't afford to stay at a hotel, so she went back to her home in Northern Ireland. And of course, because of that, they've said that she's broken her probation. And she's looking at possibly going back to prison for that. Plus, she's looking at possibly going to prison for this. And they do really seem to be going for her. And she seems to me to, her ideas and her views do seem to be maturing somewhat. She's talking about the biggest problem being the fact that we're not producing enough to replace ourselves, and that it's not like Islam invaded Britain. It was traitors among our own people that opened up the borders and invited them in. And it's traitors among our own people that signed these laws into reality. You know, it's the traitors that we have in Parliament that are causing these problems. Muslims just behave like Muslims do. Jews just behave like Jews do. Negroes behave like Negroes do. We can't expect them to do anything different. The problem is with ourselves, and we have to look to ourselves and our own characters to improve upon this. And these are the ideas that she's having, that she was talking about, that I saw in an interview the other day. So it does seem that her views have improved since she was in prison, and it definitely seems Paul Golding's views have improved. He gave a wonderful speech a while back, but it just saddens me that this young lady is being treated like this by the state and silenced like this, because again, it's somebody that loves their country, whether we agree with her views on ethno-nationalism or not, she still stands up for the British people, and she's still very vocal. She had 3 million supporters on her Facebook page, and that was taken down while she was in prison. You think about that. 3 million people were supporting her that she was connected with, and she was with a legitimate political party. Britain First are a registered political party, and you've got this private corporation that just takes down her ability to talk to people. Now, she really should have thought of that in the first place and not used Facebook as their primary platform. But it does seem that the civic nationalists do seem to be repeating the same mistakes that ethno-nationalists were making 3 or 4 years back. I mean, we've never had a Facebook as a platform here, Radio Erin, because we knew that they could just take it away at any moment. Again, Lucy Brown or Lucy Frown, she's recently done an interview with the BBC. I mean, why on earth would you do an interview with the BBC? And then she's shocked that they stitched her up and made her look bad in it. It's like the civic nationalists, haven't learned from the mistakes that the white nationalists have made.
I think the part of the problem here, and a lot of people don't realise this, is that when you are speaking to a crowd of people, what you're hoping to do is to motivate them to action of one sort or another, and the way to motivate somebody to action through speech is to pack your speech with emotive phrases, because it's emotion that makes people decide to act. It's not logic, cold hard reason. It's emotion. And so if you want to motivate people to take action in a political cause, then you've got to pack your speech with lots of emotive phrases. And the problem with emotive phrases is that when you're delivering a speech and you are delivering these emotive phrases, you find it very stirring, and you find that you can almost feel the adrenaline flooding into your body. You almost get like a cold feeling at the, you know, on your back, where all this adrenaline is suddenly sort of pumping into you, especially if you're doing it in an open air demonstration where there are lots of Antifa people just a little way down the road that are all baying for your blood. You know, that again creates a situation where there's a lot of adrenaline pumping around. And when you're speaking in that kind of a situation and you're trying to pack the speech that you're making with lots of emotive phrases in order to stir the audience that you have, the problem is that you end up saying things that in the cold light of day you probably wouldn't have actually said. And this is a this is a well, it's I was just going to say it's an age old problem. It's not an age old problem. It's the need to do to pack your speeches with emotive terminology, etc. is an age old principle. But it's only recent times where we've had the introduction of hate speech with zero tolerance as far as hate speech is concerned, where the moment you say something that can be regarded as hate speech, irrespective of the circumstances, irrespective of whether you in the cold light of day, well, actually, I did overstep the mark when I actually said that. You know, I would actually like to retract that little bit of my speech and just replace it with something moderate. You know, that doesn't exist. And so with this sort of zero tolerance approach, anything you say in that kind of an excitable and excited and emotive situation can and will be used against you by the state. And this is what people need to realize. And it's one reason why, there are people who are seasoned nationalist speakers who will very often deliver a speech in very measured terms, because they have recognize the fact that they need to deliver a speech in that way in order to avoid accidentally saying something which could get them prosecuted. This is the issue that I think exists with Jada Franson, because I'm sure in the cold light of day, if somebody sat back and said to her, you know, this is what you said, is this what you meant to say? And she probably would admit that she actually went a bit OTT, and that she was carried away with the excitement at the moment, and that if she was actually writing a treatise, she would have expressed herself in more measured terms.
Would you recommend people write their speeches down then? I mean, that would seem to be the thing to do, is if you're going to be giving a speech somewhere, write it all down beforehand. Don't free ride it. You know, make sure it's all written down. You've checked it all beforehand, and then read it out. That would be the best way.
You can do that, but in reading a speech, you therefore are delivering it in a slow and measured way, which diminishes the emotive impact of what you're saying. So, yes, I think that writing it down as much as possible is the thing that you need to do. But it's also what you need to have as prompts are prompt sheets or prompt cards where where what you're going to say is written large enough for you to be able to read it while you're still talking. Because part of the skill of public speaking is to listen to what you've just said, to actually say what you're saying now, and to think what you're going to say next so that everything flows, because otherwise you end up with a very stilted speech. And if you want the speech to flow, you've got to be able to do those three things all at the same time. And you can't just learn that skill overnight. It's something that people develop over a period of years. And so What people need to do is to make sure that if they're delivering a speech in public, particularly where it's going to be videoed or where somebody might be recording it, that they write it down as you've suggested, and that they very carefully vet what they're going to say beforehand, so that they don't get themselves the wrong side of the law. It will mean that initially their speech making won't sound as good as somebody that's been doing it for donkey's years, but it's better for them to deliver a speech which is factually sound, but perhaps a little bit dull in its delivery, than for them to deliver a very rousing speech where they end up saying something that they didn't really intend to and end up getting themselves in the dock, being prosecuted for incitement to racial hatred. The other thing as well is that in order to try and motivate people to action, I think that there has been a tendency on the part of lots of people to exaggerate the dire state that we're in, or not necessarily to exaggerate it, but to exaggerate the shortness of time that we've got as a window of opportunity to avert the things that we might see happening. So, for example, there are several passages in the Quran that other people have quoted, and I haven't got them prepared in front of me, so I'm not going to attempt to sort of say what they are, but where message from the Quran is that true believers should deal with non-believers in a very severe manner, and perhaps even in a violent manner. Whilst there may be some Muslims that don't believe in this, and I'm sure there are lots, in fact, that there is a minority of Muslims that do take all these things literally, just as there are Christians who take various passages of the Bible absolutely literally. And what needs to be done is that the government need to work together with Muslim leaders to get these things removed, because what we've seen, if we look around the world, where countries come under the domination by these Muslim extremist groups, is that those Muslim extremist groups then do interpret and do give action to these extreme passages that still survive within the Quran. And so we see people being beheaded, we see people being stoned, we see people being thrown off the tops of tall buildings and things of that sort. And very often, because there are different factions within Islam, we see in Islamic countries one faction fighting against the other, and that because there are passages in the Quran that advocate that when you've defeated your enemy, you should treat your enemy very severely, we've seen situations where the defeated side is treated very barbarically by the side that is the winning side. And so when people project forward what might happen in Britain if we continue to have mass immigration from Islamic countries, there is the fear that there could be an outbreak of violence against the host population, and people envisage that a kind of civil war situation could come about, and the problem is that people always envisage this sort of thing is going to happen any time now, it could happen any day now, when in reality we're a long way away from any situation of that sort. Yes, there are individual acts of violence committed against the indigenous population by Muslim extremists and vice versa, but we're still a long way from a situation that is anything comparable to a civil war. And my feeling is that many of us and many of the people listening to this broadcast here today will probably be 6 feet under before anything like that does take place. It doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't take account of the fact that kind of a situation could never happen in the future. It just means that we don't have to use intemperate language and try and stir people to action out of a sense of panic. What we need to do is just to make people aware of the fact that the future could be a much more violent place than it is today, and that we do need to take and perhaps work earnestly towards taking steps to prevent that from happening. But we don't have to use language quite as intemperate as Jada Francis reported to have used in these newspaper articles, whether she did actually say these things or not, she's reported to have saying them. And when you read them, yeah, they do sound like very intemperate statements. And as I said before, I'm sure in the cold light of day, she probably would have wanted to have expressed herself a little bit more in a bit more of a restrained way.
Yeah, a bit more specific. I mean, I was reading an article on the Public Order Act the other day, which they tacked on the race hate legislation onto the Public Order Act. And the guidelines for that was saying that you can be offensive, but you can't be insulting. And I was thinking, well, what's the difference between being offensive and being insulting? Well, I guess if something is truthful, then and it's offensive, then you would be okay. But if it wasn't truthful and it was offensive, then it would be insulting. And that's what you've got here. When she says that Islam says every single one of you wonderful people here today deserves to be killed, I mean, that's insulting rather than just offensive, because that isn't 100% accurate, because there are people in Islam that don't want to see everybody killed. And it's the same with if she was pointing out what the Quran had to say, rather than saying that it was Islam, then people could say, well, that was offensive, but they could say you can't say that it's insulting because it's the truth. How can the truth be insulting? So I think that's a difference that people can think about.
Well, what I was going to say is that rather than trying to raise the to hold up the Muslim community as a kind of bogeyman in this kind of a situation, and rather than trying to give the impression that that Islam is akin to being the root of all evil, and in the same way, instead of some people who are anti-Semitic holding Jews up and trying to create the impression that Jews are the root of all evil, what we need to focus on, and this is what this is a way of avoiding incitement to racial hatred, is to focus on what's going on. And what's going on is that in Britain, the politicians at Westminster are deliberately constructing a multicultural and multiracial society where one didn't exist before. And what we have to recognise is that when you create a multicultural society, what tends to happen is that each ethnic group or each cultural or racial group forms its own representative body that represents its interests, and that representative body is expected by its members to campaign in the interests of the ethnic or racial group or religious group that's there. And so what tends to grow up over time, and this is the social dynamics of a multicultural and multiracial society, is that instead of having one society, what you end up with is several parallel societies, each with its own representative leadership, each of which is competing with all of the other parallel societies for an increased share of finite resources. And this then inevitably ends up with antagonism being caused between the different ethnic groups. And as history has shown, from time to time, this antagonism boils over into violence. And as sociology has shown, the sort of antagonisms that exist and the mutual rivalries that exist within a multicultural society mean that people become less charitable even, and less prepared to turn the other cheek than they would have done otherwise. And they reserve their charity and their forgiveness for people more for people of their own ethnic group, and they tend to deny that charity and forgiveness to people of competing ethnic groups. So you end up with a dysfunctional society. And this is what we've got to concentrate on here, not picking on one particular ethnic group and trying to portray them as the root of all evil, but to explain why a multicultural society will inevitably become a dysfunctional society. And then to say to people, you don't have to hate anybody. All you need to do is to agree that you don't want to live in a dysfunctional society. And so therefore, in order to prevent your society from becoming dysfunctional, all we need to do is to maintain it as a monoracial, monocultural society, rather than trying to create this hodgepodge society multicultural societies actually are. And that's the solution to it. That way you can then deliver a speech where what you're doing is you're talking about the fact that we don't want a multicultural society because it will inevitably become dysfunctional. We don't want all these various things to happen which will take us towards a multicultural society because we know what the end result of that is. It's dysfunction. And that dysfunction can take various forms. And in the most extreme cases, it will result in interethnic violence. And in the really, really most extreme cases, it will result in a civil war kind of situation. And we can look around the world and we can look at examples of where this has happened, and we can look through history and look at examples of where this has happened to prove our case. We don't have to risk exposing ourselves to the possibility of being prosecuted for incitement to racial hatred.
Yeah, we need to isolate identify the reasons why all this is happening, because it's our own people that have permitted it to happen, essentially. And so I say these other races, they do what they do. We are responsible for what we do, and what we have done is permit all of this to happen. And the only way we can stop it is to stop permitting it to happen. And we can't change what the government does, but we can change the way that we behave and the way that we respond, and we can make differences in the lives of the people that are around us. That's what I think is more important, is working on our own character. You were saying there about the frictions between the different communities. I mean, it's frictions within the communities as well. I mean, the big thing at the moment is the rate of violent stabbings and murders that are going on in the multicultural centres. And it's predominantly blacks that are involved in that. And as Peter Rushton was pointing out the other day, it's a lot of the victims are Pakistanis, because they're the ones that own the shops that the violence occurs in. And they change that. What they've done to try and deal with this, instead of deporting the people responsible for it, who are five times more likely to be involved in violent crime than any other ethnicity in Britain, instead of deporting them, they're going to change the stop and search powers. And again, this is another huge failure for Theresa May, because she was the one that messed around with them in the first place and said that the stop and search powers were racist and far too many Negroes are being stopped and searched and it should be the same number of whites. And the end result of that was this massive increase in stabbings that we've seen, where there's stabbings occurring every day, hundreds of stabbings a year we're having now, and people being murdered pretty much every day of the week. So they've changed the stop and search powers so that they no longer need reasonable suspicion, which is what they had to have before. And this might take a few more knives off the streets, but I don't think it's going to stop the violence, because if these people can't get hold of knives, they'll just get hold of something else. I mean, this is why we've had this rise in acid attacks. It's because people didn't want to be caught with a knife. They didn't want to be caught with a gun. So they moved on to carrying acid around. And they'll just move on to carrying something else. The only way to deal with this problem is to segregate the population, the problem population, which is causing it. This is why you don't get, a high rate of people stabbing one another in Iceland, because they don't have a multicultural society in Iceland. And this is why you get the most amount of violence happening in London and Birmingham, because they are the most multicultural parts of Britain. I mean, this is good that they are changing the law so that they don't need reasonable suspicion anymore. But it's kind of like, trying to just put a band-aid on it. It's not actually dealing with the root causes. And the root causes aren't that these people don't have anything to do. They don't have ping pong tables and pool tables. The root cause of it is that they are five times more likely to carry out violent crime than white people. I mean, that's the basic cause of all this. That's why there's five times as many of them in prison. That's why they commit five times as much violent crime. It's not because we're racist towards them. It's just because that's the way that they are. That's the reality. And again, that's not insulting. They may find that offensive to hear that, but that's the facts. That is the statistics. And the only way to deal with it is to remove them, repatriate them. Max, thank you very much for coming on today. Do you want to add anything to that about the stop and search powers?
I was just really going to say that when you live in a multicultural society or a multiracial society, because so much of what is going on around you is alien, and when you walk through various parts of the town, you suddenly find that you're in a part of the town where a different ethnic group predominates and where the character of that area is alien to you, it creates feelings of disorientation, feelings that you're out of place, that you're in a foreign country. And as I was saying earlier on, this tends to make you feel less well disposed to the people around you. You feel to a certain extent under threat because you know that you're in that you're out of place, and that you the majority of the people in that area are going to feel differently towards you and not going to regard you as one of them in the same way that they regard each other, and that makes people feel less inclined to obey the law and to be lawful, and so therefore when you are involved in a situation a rivalry situation, and obviously a lot of these stabbings are in association with drug trafficking, and where you get these various drug gangs that find themselves in situations of rivalry, they then have very little to hold them back from engaging in violence, because they believe the people they're fighting against are alien. They believe the people they're fighting against are representatives of a criminal justice system that has nothing to do with them and that they reject, and so they feel far more readily inclined to break the law and to respond to any kind of provocation with violence. Yeah, this is what we see.
I don't think this is going to solve the problem at all. It might take a few more knives off the streets, but the level of violent crime is still going to increase. That's my prediction anyway. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Monday with more Area in Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you all have a great week ahead of you.
To the anti-white system on RadioArea.com.